Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Being Yourself podcast. Hello, and again, welcome to the Being Yourself podcast. I am your host, Andres Cintrón, and today we have a very special guest and a very important topic to discuss. So helping me with this episode is someone that has been a support for me in higher education and inspiration. This person was one of my professors during graduate school and is currently the Associate Dean at WPI. So Emily, welcome to the Being Yourself podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to have this conversation today.
No, thank you. Absolutely. You were one of the first person that I thought about when I started doing the coming together with a podcast, primarily because I just think that you have so much knowledge and it would be great to have a conversation with you. So really much thank you. Even though you were thinking to yourself, why me?
I was. When you shared that you were starting the podcast, and particularly really exploring identities, I thought to myself, why would you choose me? I'm, a upper middle class Christian white lady. I did grow up in a multi-faith household. My dad is Jewish. My mom is Christian. But I thought to myself, what do I have to bring to the table? But I certainly care deeply about helping the students I work with explore identity and understand the identities of others so that they can be better higher ed practitioners. And so I'm excited to have this conversation with you today.
Yeah, no, thank you. I think it's interesting because you tell me that you think you have so much to include and to provide into this conversation in terms of identity. But just even listening about your experience in terms of growing up in a multi-religious household, that for me is interesting. I'm like, oh, what is that like, right? So it doesn't necessarily have to be in terms of being, when I think about identity, it doesn't have to be always race or always ethnicity or gender, right? There's so many different aspects of identity, of things that make us who we are, that I think is so interesting and so valuable to look into.
I completely agree. There's, every person is shaped by their journey, right? And so that journey is unique to that person. Everything from, their abilities, the faith that they grew up, the language they grew up speaking, the place where they grew up shapes their perspectives.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. I think definitely if I look back at my own experiences, whether I might, be next to another person who also identifies as Puerto Rican, I grew up in mostly in the United States. I didn't grow up in Puerto Rico like my cousins did. So I know I have a different understanding of my identity and a different perspective and experience than my cousins who grew up in Puerto Rico. Even though we share the same nationality or ethnicity, I guess you could say.
Well, and I think about where, and you're kind of speaking to this, the context in which we are placed shapes that as well. So I grew up in a small town in Ohio. It's a sort of a city surrounded by a farm community. And, within that community, there's the movie Hillbilly Elegy just came out.
Yes,
I don't know if you read or read the book.
The
book is placed in Ohio in a small town that's a sort of old industrial town. And as I read that book, I thought this is describing my hometown in many ways. People worked at the glass factory or in the service industry. And so in my hometown, my family is certainly not wealthy. But in the context of that hometown, my family was better off than many in my town. But then I went to college where I was surrounded by folks who came from pretty well-heeled families. And so then my sort of privilege shifted in the context in which I was placed also. So I always thought that was sort of very interesting. I remember the first time I realized social class was going over to my friend's neighbor friend, I'm probably 11. And her mom was a single mom, four kids. And they asked me what I had for dinner. And it was like a Wednesday night. And I said, well, we had steak. And her mom thought, well, I'm a snob because I have steak. I didn't know I was 11, right? I had no idea. And that was really sort of my first awareness that maybe my family had a little bit more than some of the folks around me.
That's very interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. Even with food, you can sense someone's idea of or experience of privilege, I guess you could say. I remember I have my own. When we grew up, when we came from Puerto Rico, we really didn't have a lot, and I always associate certain dishes that my mother would make to a specific time, to a specific experience in terms of like. This is what we had when we first came to Hartford, Connecticut, when we were kids, and my mom was working two jobs, and this is what we could get for food sometimes, and this is what she would always make, and it was very simple, but I always associate that with that experience of my identity in terms of my experience being, coming to Puerto Rico and not having a lot of, money, and we just didn't have a lot of stuff.
And it evokes emotions and feelings associated with that sort of food association.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. To our point, it's our experiences that shape who we are, shape our understanding of ourselves, our identity. And I think that's a beautiful thing about it.
It is. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love working with college age students, because each student has a unique story. And the opportunity to sort of help them grapple with their own identities. I think a lot of college age students first really start to place their identity and decide which identities are most salient for them. Mm. Typically in that, 17 to 25 age range, which are the identity components that are going to be defining for me as an individual versus someone else, and how do I manifest those, and how do I express them, and how do I talk about them? And so it's pretty interesting to get to meet so many different folks with different life experiences and hear how they're making sense of those experiences.
Right. Absolutely. And, I mentioned this in one of my episodes, but it's time. I think you're right to make sense of your identities, to make sense of who you are, it takes time. It takes experience and growth to really figure it out and kind of, I want to say assess, but just kind of really understand and how do your identities impact you and maybe others as well.
Well, and I think one thing I've observed is students being able to learn. I think it's problematizing experiences they have where perhaps maybe someone's privilege is being exerted over them, as an example. And so I see sometimes folks who sort of accepted that as a lived experience starting to feel more confident and comfortable calling it out. Not that they should have to. They shouldn't be placed in that situation where they have to. But I also, as students sort of grapple with who they are, also being willing to say this structure, this norm, this cultural expectation does not help me succeed. And I'm going to give voice to that. Right. I see that when I work with a lot of our, transitioning or transgender students who, I'm can feel a little like death by a thousand paper cuts when you're constantly misgendered or when systems aren't built to recognize your gender identity versus your legal gender. When someone's asking you for a state ID and you live in a state where you can't get one. Right. Helping create spaces where folks can raise those as concerns and where allies and advocates can use their privilege to change those systems and structures. That's the stuff I get pretty excited about.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that I actually wanted to talk to you about amongst, the topic of privilege, or, I think would be really crucial for us to talk about. And you know, at a basic level for those who are listening out there as well. But, you know, and part of your work that I admire is you're giving, you know, and I want you to talk about this, is you're giving someone an identity for themselves in terms of, and a power. I think of it's giving them the ability to have the name that they want, right? It's, for some people, it may seem, oh, it's just a name. Why, you know, it's just a name. Why can't you just use your, you know, birth name or so on? But it's so much more than that. And it gives that person so much more power. And I mean by power, I mean about themselves, about control of who they are and acceptance for themselves and say, this is who I am. This is me.
Yeah. There's nothing more personal to someone than their name.
Yeah.
I think back to, when I was in college and I was a member of a bunch of organizations, we would always talk about sort of recruiting new folks and that the most important thing you could do is address someone by their name because that's theirs. It belongs to them. Mm. And imagine if you live in a body that doesn't align with how you identify and you're called a name that you don't identify with. And, you know, I think some of the folks I work with have really supportive families. Some of the folks I work with do not, right? I work with some families that continue to use the wrong pronouns, even though they know and their student has expressed that they want to be called a different name or use different pronouns. And so to be able to come to a place where folks say, I value you for how you identify and I will call you what you are called. There is a lot of power in that. But I think the thing that I find challenging about it is that right now at WPI where I work, the systems require students to kind of come through me as a gatekeeper. And I don't like that. I don't like the fact that a student has to identify themselves to me. I want to build systems and structures where that is seamless, where someone can say, this is the name I wish to be called. And every system change, that name changes. Mm. So to build a universal design type system where folks can make that change, disclose the gender identity, share the name they wish to be called. And it changes on class rosters. It changes on a housing roster. It changes in the billing system if they wish it. And so that's my dream is to, how do we sort of step back for a minute and instead of we can create a short-term solution where folks can come and identify themselves to me, but I want to build a system where anyone can access that from any place, unknown to anyone. And so then that's a way for folks to really truly own their own identity versus having to, I'm the associate dean of students and you have to come through me. Once again, that's sort of my power and my privilege. Mm-hmm. And they have to work through mine, my power and my privilege, which I find problematic. And so how do we sort of build systems that empower folks to access those systems when they choose to?
Right.
There's an author, the two authors, Strange and Banning wrote a book sort of from an approach called a campus ecology, this idea that every college campus is an ecosystem. And they reference the campus porch, this idea that folks can kind of stand on the porch and look out into the ecosystem and decide how they want to engage with that ecosystem. I want to build systems and structures that empower folks to decide what that looks like, as opposed to having to work with a gatekeeper who decides what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, that is fantastic. And I think to, what you're saying and what really sparked my interest is, or as we were having our conversation about privilege is that, you know, to your point, you are in a position of privilege where you're privileged enough that you can help these individuals who don't have the privilege to be able to do it for themselves because, right, because they just don't have it or the systems, the way the systems are. And to your point is you're trying to find a way to change that system.
Yeah. And I think it's about there needs to be more folks who have privilege that want to mm-hmm. give and empower voices for those who maybe have historically not had that level of privilege or been marginalized in some way. But I think it's not enough to just raise it, right? Mm-hmm. There are a lot of sort of champions who will raise questions or challenges or say this system is oppressive. It's not enough to do that. It's about how do you shift those systems of oppression? How do you change the processes or the procedures or the expectations or the norms?
Right.
You know, for example, I don't think it's enough to just offer one single stall, gender inclusive / accessible bathroom in every building. It's not enough.
Right.
We should be having fully accessible bathrooms everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of that is challenging, right? A lot of old college campuses with old buildings are not designed that way.
Right.
And they're not easily retrofittable. And so how do you, you know, you being the collective sort of folks with voice, start to raise those things, but also start to say, it's not enough to just slap a gender inclusive sign on a single use restroom, right?
Right.
That's not enough. And what's it going to take for us to truly be inclusive, truly be universally designed?
Right.
And I think it's challenging sometimes to do that as a person of privilege, because we don't experience the world the same way.
Mm.
Right. And so in some ways I feel like a jerk advocating for things that I don't experience, because then am I stealing someone else's voice? Right. But if that voice is not being heard, how do I raise those voices? And I think that's the challenge sometimes.
It's being an advocate, you know? And I think, you know, I just want to get into that topic, you know, about a privilege, you know, because, mm-hmm. You know, we've been kind of bouncing around it, and there's so much positive that we can do with privilege, you know. You know, but what is privilege, right? If we were trying to identify that.
That's a great question. There's some great readings on privilege. Crenshaw is a good resource for folks to check out if they're interested. You know, if you look at it from a critical race theory, which is sort of this, and there's critical feminist theory, mm-hmm. but sort of a critical theory lens is going to suggest that some people have power and some people do not. And that systems are designed in such a way to continue to maintain the power of those in power.
Right.
And privilege aligns with that in the sense that some of us carry power just by virtue of our own identities. Mm. You know, and a simple example of that, Peggy McIntosh wrote a short piece called Unpacking the Invisible White Knapsack. And she provides a list of things that white people have access to or don't have to worry about that people of color sometimes do have to worry about. Mm-hmm. Things as simple as, this has shifted a bit since she wrote her article, but being able to buy a Band-Aid that matches your skin color, the reference to, I'm a member of a sorority, nude heels. What exactly is nude? But things even more, sort of serious, like I have the privilege to walk into a store and not worry that someone is going to look at me like I'm going to steal something. I've never mm-hmm. had to worry about that. I can walk in onto a car lot and no one's going to question whether I have the ability to purchase that car or the credit to do so. And so privilege empowers folks. It gives folks advantages that, and I think about conversations around privilege I've had with students, particularly those that have it. It can sometimes invoke some anger because it's not something that folks necessarily ask for or wish to have, or but I think acknowledging that we have it and figuring out how to wield it responsibly is the challenge that I think many of us have to grapple with.
Mm-hmm.
And when some of those advantages are invisible to us, it's getting visibility into those advantages. It's also acknowledging what you don't know, right? So I'll use this,
right.
The example of working with some of our trans or transitioning students. When I log into every, we have about 90 different software systems that pull data from our central sort of database. Every one of those systems that I use, I can't tell if it's using someone's legal name or someone's lived name, because I go by both, you know, that my lived name is my legal name. And so I'm experiencing the world in a way that seems seamless to me that may not be for someone else. And some of that may be invisible to me if I don't know to ask or question that. Mm. And so I think that's the challenge of those with privilege, is knowing to problematize the things they see. There's a ethnographer who talks about the importance of making the hidden obvious, the obvious dubious. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important for us to, what seems obvious to us as a truth, is it really the truth? Right. And what's hidden to us, and how do we make that visible? Those are, I think, our challenges for those with privilege, is to really dig in and figure, learn, reflect, be open. And those are difficult things to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, for me, in my experiences, because, you know, I think everyone at some point have some privilege and have some disadvantages in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. I, for example, I know that I'm on the white end of my skin tone. I am, you know, I can pass for white. And as opposed to, I have cousins who are much darker. And, you know, because in Puerto Rico, we have, you know, you have both extremes. You have very white because of the Spanish influence, and then you have very dark because of the African Indian influence, right? My experiences are completely different than my cousin's experiences. And I own that. And in order for me to have owned that, I think for anyone is having those conversations, getting input, getting feedback from others. And, you know, as you mentioned, some students get upset or because they're confronted with these new ideas, that they're like, oh wait, I didn't choose to have this privilege. And I'm pretty sure there's other people who would say, well, I didn't choose not to have this privilege either, right? But I think we need to get to a point where we need to be comfortable with being uncomfortable, right? We need to have conversations, even if they make you uncomfortable, if they make you feel like, oh, you might feel like I have nothing to add to this, or I feel like I'm the bad person, or it's not that. It's just, we just need to have conversations. We need to understand each other, have feedback, and listen to each other.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. And I think that's the very first step. I think the next step is really challenging the systems. Mm-hmm. How do we address those systems that, and, you know, prioritize or privilege whiteness or straightness or gender conformity or ability, or, you know, I think certainly we would list a lot of privileges. I once wrote an article talking about normative systems in fraternity and sorority recruitment. My background is in fraternity and sorority advising, and you want to talk about a place where privilege is highly visible. Mm-hmm. You know, and so how do we start to dismantle some of those systems, right? You know, I think about telling sorority women that the attire for a recruitment event is that your hair must be stick straight and you must wear these certain clothes, and that doesn't account for different hair types, doesn't account for different body types. Sort of this culture of conformity that sometimes is reinforced, and frankly, none of the members actually like it. Right. So why do we keep doing it?
Right.
And so empowering the voices that can help say, why are we doing this? Let's stop doing this. It's actually been really fascinating. Across the country, I think about fraternity and sorority recruitment has mostly been conducted over Zoom during the pandemic. Mm. And it has totally changed the groups that people are joining, because in some ways it's gotten rid of some of the, you know, uniformity, conformity. It's created some, there's still some, you know, technology accessibility challenges for someone who maybe have difficulty with accessibility, but, you know, when folks are seeing you from the, you know, chest up,
right,
they're not making judgments on superficial reasons. And so I find that really fascinating, and I'm interested to see how that shapes and changes organizations.
I was thinking the same way. I'd be very interested to see how that changes. I think it's interesting because I think there's this year has definitely it's been tough for everybody, but I tend to be more on the optimistic end or the spectrum. And I always think, there's a lot to learn from this experience. Even if you've gone through some hardship and traumatic experiences, finding a way to learn from these experiences, and if you can.
Absolutely. But I think the pandemic has even further exacerbated some of the privileges that mm-hmm. are clear in our society. Who's continued working and who hasn't?
Yeah.
Who knew how to access and were able to access unemployment benefits, for example? How accessible were those?
Did you have health insurance? Were you accessible to good healthcare?
Exactly.
Communities that don't have that and others that do.
Who has the privilege to work at home and who doesn't? Right. My partner pours concrete for a living. He doesn't get to do that on Zoom. So who had no choice but to be out and maybe at higher risk because of that, and who could, stay in the shelter of their home. These are all, I think, things that have made it glaringly clear the privileges that exist in our society. Mm. And I'm hopeful that our generation of youth are seeing those things. And I'm hearing more students raise voices about the need to dismantle some of these systems mm-hmm. or create more equitable access to resources that help provide a more equitable world.
Yeah. I mean, you've been at WPI for much longer than I have, but, even in the short period that I've been at WPI, I am amazed at how dedicated and motivated the students are in terms of, when we talk about injustices and equality and accessibility and all of those things. And I mean, I see it from the students I interact on a daily basis. It's quite interesting and amazing. I think it's definitely this generation that's mm-hmm. going to hopefully make those changes that we need.
It definitely is. And it's interesting, in my 15 years at WPI, I've seen that shift a bit. I think let me share my observation. So I did a research study maybe about 5 or 6 years ago where I interviewed students for how they got into STEM. And I was specifically interested in students of color and their experiences. And so I had, an ethnographic study where I interviewed students and trying to talk to them about their journeys. And I started every single one of those interviews by saying, tell me who you are. Who are you? Mm. Every single one of them answered their major first. They told me what they were studying. And some of that's a STEM student, right? Their engineering mm-hmm. identity.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to tease out some of the other stories that were truly defining for those students. So, mm-hmm. I was probably 30 minutes into an hour-long interview with a student before he mentioned that he immigrated from Brazil when he was 12, and he was good at math because the symbols were the same. He didn't speak English that well yet, kind of thrust into the public school system, having never learned English. And so he liked math because he understood it, and he didn't quite understand some of his other courses yet. And so I wanted to be like, why didn't you bring that up first? That's fascinating. I want to know more about that. And I think now if I were to replicate that study and I were to start with just an open-ended question of who are you, I think students would talk more about their identities. Mm. And so I think that's creating voice for a space for people to talk about those identities, I think, is a very important first step as we move students to a place where they're not just advocates and allies, but they truly are sort of thinking about systems and structures and norms and thinking about how to change those, because they're going to go off into the engineering world which is heavily, you know, straight male identified, mm-hmm. Dominated. And I'm expecting big things from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, this is why I just love, in our conversations about identity, because I think it's so fascinating. We all have something to share and bring to the table, and something that's so unique to us and our experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, that reminds me, one of my conversations with one of my students, and we talked about the privilege of being a male in engineering, right? Because it's such a male-driven field. And a lot of, you know, there's a lack of representation of women. There's a lack of push for, I don't want to say push, but just, you know, I think, and I don't know about your experience, but I'm sure that, you know, being raised as a boy and being raised as a girl, it's completely different in terms of the way that your parents, you know, for example, the boys get, you know, to do some of the harder jobs, or like play with toys, with cars, or they're more rough, where the girls don't, right? And I think some of that, I think, right, plays into the fields we go into and as we grow up, right? And I think in that perspective, when we talk about engineering, and I think it could be that, right? It's like men go into those fields or business, and, you know, women's going to teaching or clerical work or something like that.
Well, you know, and I have a great example of that. So growing up, I was very good at math. I was very good at science. It came really easily to me. It was very interesting. No one ever talked to me about engineering. I didn't even know what an engineer did until I dated someone majoring in engineering in college. And I think about that as really, you know, I'm certainly very happy in my career, but I can't help but wonder if I knew that this was a thing you could do, would I have been interested in it? It's mm-hmm. problem solving. I love to do that. It's, you know, all the fields that I was really interested in and good at, that came pretty easily to me. But I didn't even know that was a thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think, you know, that sort of speaks to the way that folks are sort of directed based on maybe some gender assumptions, certainly. Right. As part of that same study I described, I remember interviewing a gentleman who was a computer science major, and he talked about, he was also Puerto Rican, and he talked about walking into class, and he would just count. He said, I would just count the number of women and the number of people of color to see which one was more, because it's usually only one or two in both mm-hmm. cases. I think that's shifting a little. I think more girls are learning about engineering. Certainly, you know, WPI is seeing more and more women enrolling at WPI. You know, efforts like Girls Who Code and mm-hmm. some of those other efforts are really introducing young women, because really and truly, you need to be taking the right math in eighth grade to be ready to do the level of calculus you need to do when you get to college to study engineering. And so,
right.
I think that's true for girls, you know, sort of making sure that they're sort of in that right channel, that they're thinking about careers and things like computer science or engineering is important. But I also think that, speaking to the math piece, you think about sort of larger systems and structures, right? So mm-hmm. think about the resources that some high schools have and some high schools don't have. Mm-hmm. I work with some students who didn't get to take calculus in high school because of the resources that their high school just didn't allow for that. And yeah. so there's like a built-in privilege. So you come, right. And one of the students I interviewed talked about this. He said, so I didn't take calculus in high school. And then I came and I'm in calculus with a bunch of people who are taking it for the second time. So who's going to get a better grade? Right.
Right.
And especially at WPI, where our terms are 7 weeks long. So you're learning calculus one in 7 weeks, and a bunch of folks have already taken it and you've never, ever taken it. Who's going to wow. outperform who? And so that's an example of a sort of privilege that some folks come to the table with that others don't have, and yet are being, the metrics that they're being held against are the same mm-hmm. in terms right. of academic performance, academic progress, things like that.
Right. I mean, right then and there, you know, I kept thinking to myself, you know, we literally just talked about gender privilege, right? Being a male and versus a female, and educational privilege, right? Having the ability to get a good education and having that privilege. You know, it's, you know, that this idea of privilege can affect us in so many different ways. There's so many elements of the, you know, components of this term and this idea. And we can definitely go into so many different topics of it. You know, and I know that we are coming up on our time together. And I definitely want to continue having it's, you know, this conversation has inspired me to have so much more conversations around this topic and much more. But I guess just as we conclude our session, you know, what are some things that others out there who maybe don't know how to, you know, figure out what their privilege is, right? Or figure out or starting to think about it and like, oh, do I have privilege? You know, what can they do? You know, what would you say, you know, what can be their starting point, I guess?
That's a great question. I think it starts with becoming more educated, right? So it's digesting, whether that's listening to podcasts or reading a book or a short article, you know, simply getting online and Googling what is privilege. There are a lot of resources out there. To become more aware of one's own privileges is important. To lean into the what they call cognitive dissonance that you're going to experience, because no one wants to feel like they have harmed or hurt or disadvantaged someone else. That feels bad, because I think inevitably many of us want to be good people and want to have a more just world. Mm. And so to sort of lean into that discomfort as you're reading and learning more, that's something that I highly, highly encourage. The next thing to do, I think, is to spend some time really thinking and reflecting on ways that you help support some of those systems of privilege. And that takes time. That is not a sit down for 20 minutes kind of thing. That's something I'm working through every single day. And this is a journey that never ends. You will never have a time where you say to yourself, check, I am fully culturally competent.
Right.
Because as soon as I feel like I've got it, then I don't have it. And so I think it's really important to own that this is a journey and an exploration. And it's an imperfect journey.
Right.
You know, I was sharing with you when we first started, I get a little nervous sometimes because I'm worried I'm going to say a dumb white lady thing. And I own that, and I want to be challenged on those things, because if I say a dumb white lady thing, I hope that someone will have the courage to share that with me. Because I want to be better, and I want to make sure that I'm helping build that more just world. And so my advice to folks who might be listening would be, lean into that, own that you're fallible, but be better next time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I'm going to continue, you know, doing that and taking more of that advice and continuing my journey and my responsibility and making sure that I am the best human being that I can possibly be, and knowing that we are humans, you know, mm-hmm. we're going to make mistakes. So we live and we learn from them. And I think it's the key component there for me is, what do I do with that new knowledge that I just learned? And I hope that, you know, people think about that. You just learned something. What are you going to do with that? You know, but thank you so much for being here. And I love this. This was great. I really want to thank you again for being a part of the podcast and agreeing to be in this episode and doing an episode with you.
Oh, this has been really fun. And thank you for inviting me to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm sure we'll see each other around.
I hope so.
Yes. All right. Thank you so much, Emily.
No problem.
All right. So that concludes our episode. Again, thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Being Yourself podcast. And if you're wondering when is the next episode coming out or what's going on with the podcast, make sure you follow the Facebook page at facebook.com/beingyourself. You may also find us on Instagram at being.yourself. And again, thank you, and until next time.